Today on Straight Talk Africa, a look at the challenges that climate change poses in Africa. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing climate change and what initiatives African governments are taking to combat it. Thousands of Africans are joining the climate change protest movement across the continent. They are calling for efforts to save the planet. My colleague, Paul Diho, has more on the story.
Africans worldwide are demonstrating and voicing their concerns about climate change.
We're here to raise our voices. We know that climate change has already started and it's killing us. We're here to tell our leaders to take a serious action.
Young people in 160 countries recently protested, calling for a climate emergency to be declared before it's too late.
It's going to affect everybody, rich or poor. Doesn't matter who you are, where you are in the world, it's going to influence you. So it's going to force us to work together. If we don't work together, we won't survive.
The demonstrations are partly led by a teenage climate change activist, Greta Thunberg, who on Monday opened the United Nations Climate Action Summit with an angry condemnation of world leaders for failing to take strong measures to combat climate change.
You all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones.
Experts say Africa is the most vulnerable continent to climate change and the least equipped to deal with it.
Essentially, young people have come together and said they are not going to allow this generation to not take decisive action on climate change.
Many African governments are pleading for more support from the international community.
We started this when we saw the effects in Kenya, the droughts in the north and the fires that were on Mount Kenya. We were really upset that no one did anything about it. And we were seeing people in Europe and in the US, they were protesting about this. But we realized that here nothing was being done. So that's why we wanted to start.
A new United Nations report entitled The Heat Is On showcases how the world can take swift and meaningful action on climate change. At a launch event in New York, Amina Mohammed, Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, spoke about what she would like to see happen.
When I look back on this Climate Action Summit, I want us to see this as a slingshot, that springboard, to helping to change our common trajectory towards sustainability, where we build trust between this generation of adults and the next, between our children and ourselves, and that we are all working together to our fullest potential to tackle the climate emergency.
The Central African nation of Gabon is working diligently to battle climate change. The United Nations announced that this week that it is set to become the first African country to be paid with international funds that preserve its forests to fight climate change.
We signed an agreement which commits Norway to paying up to $150 million to Gabon for reduced emissions from the forestry sector. So reduced emissions from deforestation or from the degradation of the forests.
According to the Central African Forest Initiative, a program launched by the United Nations to bring together the region's countries with Western donors. The UN invited nearly 500 young activists and entrepreneurs to participate in this week's UN climate change meeting, the first of its kind. Unfortunately, some activists were unable to attend after being denied a U.S. visa. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Paul, for the report. Joining me now from the headquarters of the United Nations in New York is our VOA UN correspondent, Margaret Beshia. Good afternoon, Margaret.
Hi, Shaka.
How are you?
Hi, Shaka. Thanks for having me on. Good. Busy week.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you again after a very, very, very long time. What is the mood like in New York?
Well, it's very intense. That's how I would describe it. Everybody has so much to do, so many issues that they want to put in the spotlight this week. And so they're all very focused on trying to draw the most attention that they can to their issue.
Now, you have, of course, had some speeches, among others, from Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old lady from Sweden, who basically addressed the world and seems to have impressed a lot of people.
Yeah, she was really dynamic the other day, very passionate, angry too. And she said, you know, I should be in school. I'm 16. I'm a kid. And instead I'm here, you know, trying to not to lead. She didn't say the word lead, but that's really what she's doing. She's really leading this movement of young people that started with her striking from school on Fridays. She stopped going to school on Fridays so she could sit outside the Swedish parliament to protest, you know, what she saw as their inaction on global warming. And her movement, it became a movement. Her one day a week, kids all over the world are doing it now. And she had thousands of young people here with her in New York, and they had a huge strike on Friday before the UN General Assembly started, and they had more than 200,000 people here in New York, and around the world something like 6 million.
She talked, of course, about how, for example, she and her generation are being told to go to school so that they can prepare for the future. And yet, she goes on to say that those same people who are telling them to go to school and prepare for the future are taking away their future. What exactly did she mean by that?
Well, she was very angry about that, because what she was trying to make the point is that if the leader, the generation of leaders who are in office right now, if they don't accelerate efforts to stop the planet from warming, if they don't accelerate efforts to end pollution, to clean up the environment, to do all the things that are necessary, to move away from coal and oil, to use cleaner, renewable energy, if they don't do that, there's not really going to be much of a future for Greta's generation or her children or grandchildren. So, and she sees it as an emergency that they need to do more. And in fact, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke with her, like they had a sort of an interaction at the summit, at the leaders' summit where she was invited to speak. And he saluted her, and he admitted that his generation had let the young people down. And he encouraged her and others like her to go forward and to really push their leaders to do more, because he's certainly been asking for it, and I think he feels his efforts will have more impact if a whole younger generation is there supporting him. And don't forget, Shaka, this young generation, Greta is only 16 now, but in another year or two, she'll be able to vote in her country. And young people all around the world will soon have a say in the ballot boxes, and they'll be able to vote in or out leaders who are taking care of the environment or not taking care of it. So they may be children now, but in a few years, that, you know, they're the voters of tomorrow.
Now, Margaret, traditionally, the UN General Assembly is first addressed by a Brazilian president, followed by a United States president. Now, the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, and the president of the United States, Donald Trump, according to critics, these are two very important leaders who are associated with climate change denial. How were their speeches received?
Well, President Trump didn't mention the issue of climate change in his speech at all. But the Brazilian president did, and you'll recall that the Amazon rainforest, which much of it is located in Brazil, has sustained terrible fires in recent months. And President Bolsonaro was very angry about the criticism he has received about those fires. And he said, he kind of deflected it and said that, the Amazon isn't that important and it's not the lungs of the planet, which is what people call it because it provides so much of the oxygen for our planet. So he was quite angry about the criticism he had received. The problem is in his country, he's been accused of allowing loggers and industry into the Amazon to cut down these precious trees, and because he'd rather have industry, and environmentalists and citizens, civil society, have been very critical of him for allowing this to happen.
Is that what he meant when he said or suggested that the Amazon is not the lungs of the world?
Exactly.
Now, Margaret, you've interacted a lot among delegates from, different parts of the world. Do you still get the sense that there are people who still believe that for some reason climate change is not real? Climate change is a myth in their minds.
Well, I think there are always skeptics. But the great majority of leaders who have come here and spoken so far this week have, accepted that climate change is real. They see it as a scientific fact, and they see the impact of it in their own countries. You know, we're going to hear from African leaders from Southern Africa, for instance, Mozambique, where they've had the terrible cyclones come through. We're going to hear from leaders in countries where there have been droughts and floods, and these severe weather events are becoming much more frequent in recent years. You know, you used to see a cyclone every 5 years, maybe, or a major hurricane or something every 5 years. And now, I mean, look at Mozambique. They had two within a month. So, Secretary General Guterres has been very adamant that we're going to see a lot more of this if countries do not become carbon neutral by 2050, excuse me, and if they don't cut consumption of coal, because coal is one of the big greenhouse gas emission fossil fuels. You know, they're polluting the environment.
On that note, thank you very much, Margaret, for your insight.
Thank you, Shaka. Always good to join you.
You're most welcome. Now, joining me here in the studio are two distinguished guests, Clarissa Kayosa Shegun, human rights and development consultant, Ambassador Sidi Sane, former Gambian foreign minister, and from New York, we are joined by Erica Kashambuzi, author and a former United Nations executive. Well, I have to say that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Let me come to you immediately. Clarissa, how are you? It's a very long time since you last joined us here on Straight Talk Africa.
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, it has been quite a while, but it's always an honor to be on this show.
I see. Mm-hmm. Now, talk to us about the effects of climate change, especially in Southern Africa, where you happen to come from. You come from Zambia. Zambia was very lucky. It doesn't seem to have been hit by the recent cyclones and floods.
Well, even if Zambia wasn't hit by the cyclones and the floods, we're affected because, really, the region is one. We're affected in some way or the other. Unlike was it the first big conference on climate was in 1979, I think, in Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of Africa and the developing world thought, you know, it doesn't affect us. It doesn't have anything to do with us. But as years went by, fast forward to 92, when another conference was had in Rio, a lot of leaders realized that we were all part of a global village, and it was affecting us in some way or the other, and that's where we all signed to be part of, you know, to take accountability for what was going on in our countries. Southern Africa has been hit quite bad, as you mentioned earlier. The floods in Mozambique, when Mozambique has flooded, Zambia borders Mozambique, so it affects us as well. Agriculture is disturbed, and a lot of other things, livelihood. And we have had a lot of droughts in Africa as well. Zambia, for instance, right now is going through a drought-like situation. The southern province of Zambia, which is really like the breadbasket of the country, that's where all the farming takes place. Mm-hmm. Maize, which is a staple for Zambia, is grown in southern province. So if southern province does not have maize and they're depending on the government for handouts, then we have a big problem in Zambia. One of the things that has been going on as well is load shedding. We have had an electricity problem. That all leads to environmental changes. The one big water reserve, the Kariba Dam, where we get our water, is drying up. The Victoria Falls are drying up. So it has been a very big problem. Load shedding goes on for hours. It started off with very little hours, maybe 1 hour, 2 hours, or 3 hours. Mm-hmm. But now people go for hours, 10 hours or more, without electricity, and that's not productive. If a country has to be productive, you cannot not have electricity. So those are the things that we're going through that I believe need to be taken care of immediately. Otherwise, we cannot participate in the global economy when we are so disabled in these areas, which really add to economic growth for any country. So my listening to some of the contributions with this in the UN General Assembly, mm-hmm. I was very interested listening to the chief, Mr. Guterres. His tone is like action, no more beautiful speeches you bring to the UN. We need to make action. We need to take action. And I think that's very important. And I noticed that they were dealing with five major areas this time around, climate being the first one, climate action, mm-hmm. universal health coverage for all, achieving the sustainable development goals, financing for development, and supporting small island development states. But when you really look at all of these, they all have a lot to do with climate change. You cannot attain those sustainable development goals without working, on issues that affect the climate positively. So everything, I believe, in this General Assembly was tied to climate change. And I think it's a good way forward. And I hope that it is a way forward for all of us. We are not just going to be coming up with beautiful reports that just go filed and nothing is done about the action that is supposed to follow them.
Thank you. We'll come to you a bit later. Let me come to you immediately, Ambassador Sani. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, what about your situation as far as climate change is concerned? And we're talking about West Africa, and of course you come from the Gambia.
Mm-hmm. Well, I come from the Sahel area.
Mm-hmm.
We have been battling drought for a very long time. If you can recall it back in the 70s,
right,
where we've lost a lot of livestock. Agriculture was impacted in a very, very negative way.
Mm.
So we have been battling this.
You lost a lot of arable land.
Yes. The Niger River in Mali dries up. It creates a lot of problems. The Ghanaians also are battling the same problems with the Akosombo Dam,
mm-hmm.
in which they rely heavily on. So we live it. We've seen it. And we are. Our problem is trying to get the general public, the ordinary Gambians, to be able to connect the environmental impact that climate change is having. You know, so this is a challenge for all development agents that are all on the ground.
What about the government? What about government authorities? Are they in a position to make some sort of contingency arrangements in terms of how to respond when that occurs?
Well, one way of looking at it to see, gauge the commitment of government is always to go through the budget. If you look at the budget of the environmental ministries, compare that to other non-environmental related ministries, you will see that the priorities are not being reflected in the budget.
They're elsewhere.
They are elsewhere.
They are perhaps in defense, national
they
security.
They are in defense. They are in the office of the president. This is where you have. It doesn't really reflect the priorities of the government. So this is the challenge that we face as development change agents to try to make sure that the government, particularly, reflects some of these priorities. It is a big priority because I don't see how we can effect change and impact development in our region without addressing climate change.
I see. Let me go to Eric Kashambuzi. Eric, are you there?
I'm listening.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me to your program. Once again, I have enjoyed being on your program, which is very popular, and people talk well about it, and I'm happy to be associated with it once again.
Profoundly honored for both your compliments and support. Now, Eric, you are in New York. What is the mood like there in as far as this particular summit is concerned?
Well, I think as your colleague Margaret has said, this is a mood that is, one can say, a mood of people being angry, especially the younger ones. There's a feeling that not enough is being done. And I remember when Ban Ki-moon became Secretary General, he made climate change one of his top priority areas. And he worked very hard until we went to Paris for the climate summit. And all the leaders came together. They were prepared to take action. But the problem is that, and I think here I want to be a bit honest, is that there is, as Margaret was saying, I think there is a general recognition that climate change and global warming are real. They are happening. We are seeing them. We are feeling them. But when it comes to action, there is a problem. And the problem is, who is responsible? Or what are the relative contributions of the factors that are adversely impacting the environment? You have those who say that it is natural factors, the so-called acts of God. You have those who are saying that it's human activity. But then when it comes to that, people are saying, then who is responsible? Others are saying it's those who are producing too many children. In order to feed them, you have to destroy the environment, and you create environmental problems that result in climate change and global warming. Then you have those who are saying it is poverty. They say it's poor people tend to destroy the environment. On the other hand, you have those who are saying the environment is damaged by those people who consume much more than is necessary. In fact, they don't even consume what they buy. They waste it. And they're saying if you can change the consumption pattern, that would also change the production pattern. And so the debate goes on. Now, as we have heard from Margaret and others, last Friday there was a demonstration in New York, and yesterday, I think Monday, there was a debate, and this young lady from Sweden was angry and blaming the old people for not doing enough. I agree with that, but the problem is that we are all involved in it. And as when I was working at the United Nations, I saw young people coming into the cafeteria. They eat and leave half of the food, so there's food waste. They have shoes, more shoes than they need. They have t-shirts, more than they need. They don't want to take public transport. They drive their own vehicles. They have more mobile phones. They have computers. So I think it's a question of everybody recognizing, young and old, from rich and from poor countries, that we are all participating in damaging the environment. Unless that is accepted, once that is accepted, instead of pointing a finger, then I think action will begin to take place. And I have been involved in these things since my days as a geography student. These problems have been identified. In Uganda, where I come from, the British prevented us from draining the swamps. We had to have contour farming and ridge farming, but these were imposed on the people, and we thought these were colonial impositions. As soon as we got independence, we abandoned them. Therefore, we needed to begin to have a clear consciousness that environment is real, and figure out how we can balance the interests of all these forces that are impacting the environment. Unless that is done, we are going to keep talking and talking, and no action is taken. So my advice is that what we all recognize, that climate change and global warming are real, we now need to sit down and stop blaming one another and figure out how each one of us involved in the environmental damage can agree as to what they can do to reverse the climate change in order to achieve sustainability. Let me say one thing about Zambia. I worked in Zambia as a staff member of the United Nations in the 1970s, and I left for Swaziland in 1980. In 1992, there was a drought in the whole of Southern Africa. And those farmers that were growing drought-resistant crops like millet and sorghum fared better than those that were growing maize. So I think it's important that as we try to improve our agriculture, as we try to save the environment, we need to begin to look at the crops that perhaps can resist the drought. They don't have to demand too much water, so that we can easily adapt the environment in such a manner that we produce enough food without necessarily damaging the environment. Let me stop there for now.
Very interesting. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment, so please don't go away.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
And today we are talking about Africa and climate change. Our guests are Clarissa Kayosa Shegun, human rights and development consultant, Ambassador Sidi Sane, former Gambian foreign minister, and from New York, Eric Kashambuzi, former United Nations executive. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Let me come to you immediately, Karalisa. There is no doubt when you read about efforts by African leaders to respond to the threats posed by climate change. But at the same time, people also have to live. They have to eat. When you look at the inbuilt conflict between development and climate change, what would you suggest that African leaders need to do that they are not doing already?
I believe African leaders really should push sustainable development practices, especially in farming. As you know, Africa, most of Africa is dependent on farming. So we need sustainable methods of farming. And one of the areas that, unfortunately, a few African leaders have allowed is GMOs in the nation. These, we know, destroy the environment.
What is GMOs to an ordinary person who might be listening to you or watching you?
GMO is a genetically modified organism. Mm-hmm. So, say, for example, maize. When you get maize that has been altered, tampered with, it's not natural. Mm. It destroys the environment.
It's not organic.
It's not organic. Mm. So it destroys the environment. And the problem is you cannot keep GMO seeds for the next season, whereas the old, the organic seeds you could keep for the following season. And this is what our farmers used to do. They'll keep that old seed and be self-reliant for the next season. So when you have GMOs, you plant and they destroy. And, you know, there's cross-pollination. They'll fly to the neighbors and destroy that land. So it's like, as time goes, they're destroying a larger piece of territory. So it becomes very difficult to plant organic seeds in soil that has already been eroded by chemicals. Mm-hmm. So when farmers have lost that independence to grow organic seeds or vegetation, it really becomes a problem. They become tied. They become slave to the master one more time.
So, interesting. Ambassador Sani, Eric Kashambuzi referred to where he comes from. There was a policy during colonialism that you must stay away from draining the swamps, no matter what, because draining the swamps obviously has its own consequences. I come from the same area, the same general area where Mr. Kashambuzi comes from. In my particular case, I come from Kabale, southwestern Uganda. It is an area that is at very high altitude, to the extent that at one time you couldn't mention the disease malaria. Mm-hmm. It was an alien. It was a foreigner type of disease that you would never expect anyone to suffer from. But today, malaria is an equal opportunity disease. The reason being, these swamps were in fact drained, recovered, so that the ordinary farmer wants his sweet potatoes, wants his vegetables and what have you. What should the government do in this particular case?
Well, I think, well, again, these are all effects of climate change. You have now floods in North Africa. You have floods in the southern part of Africa, Mozambique, Zambia. So I think, again, it goes back to being able to utilize certain biodegradable materials for agriculture, for instance. This is extremely important. The natural causes of those floods, it's directly related to the types of fuel that we use. We don't use renewable energy, which is extremely important. And one of the challenges that we face is to try to get governments. Governments have to come in. They are the important players in Africa. In other parts of the world, you may have the private sector. A private sector is small in most of our countries. So we try to impact any change through the government system. And we have tried to let them move away from fossil fuel to renewable energy. So this is one way of going about it. It is very difficult because, again, if you cannot relate, if they cannot relate the use of those fuels that are harmful to the environment to what is actually happening in the environment, it becomes very difficult to convince them that this is the way out. But once you can get that connection between the two and they appreciate the impact that such types of material do have on the environment, there will be change.
Eric, what about the issue of perhaps governments looking at the problem of climate change, looking at the responses really as an aspect of vital national security interest, just like they do when it comes to security, because as Ambassador Sane said, a lot of African countries, when you look at the budgets, the biggest share of the budget usually is reflected in how they fund the armed forces, and especially if those types of leaders historically came through either the barracks or through the AK-47. And sometimes also you see the budget largely reflected in State House, obviously, where the president and the first family reside.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Because there are some leaders, you and I know, who believe that you must have national security first. Once you have national security first, the rest will follow. You remember at the time of independence, and I remember what Nkrumah told us, first get independence and development will follow. It didn't follow. At the same time, we're having these leaders who are saying, let's have national security first and development will follow. That isn't happening.
When they talk about national security first, are they in fact talking about security for the nation, or are they in fact talking about security for themselves and their families and friends?
I think when they talk about national security, in my view, they are talking about creating arrangements that can keep them in power for life. They are not saying it that way, but I think that is what it means. So they come in pretending that they want national security. National security will translate into individual security, but it isn't happening that way. And I recall in Latin America, when the military came to power in the 1960s, they were also saying that the civilians had failed and the soldiers had to come in to create the right national environment that will in turn stimulate economic development. That did not happen. And by the 1990s, all the soldiers had left already. And now, what we are seeing in Africa is a repeat of what happened in Latin America, that the soldiers came in, they thought they were going to solve the problems, and they haven't solved those problems. If anything, they have made them worse. Therefore, this is the opportunity, this is the moment when we should begin to think differently. And the 2030 agenda, where I had the opportunity to participate in the negotiations, is now saying, let us integrate different aspects at the same time. You need security. Security is important, but let it be combined with economic growth, social development, and environmental protection. That is the new development paradigm that was adopted by our leaders in September 2015 and is embedded in the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. Now, unless we are prepared to change our mindset. The problem, as I see it myself, having been in development field for a long time, is changing mindset is extremely difficult. And that's why sometimes you end up with all sorts of things. Instability has to come in. Revolutions sometimes have to come in before changes can take place. But I don't believe in bloody revolutions. But I think we can have peaceful revolutions, people coming together. And I think it is happening now. The young people are coming together. Human rights activists are coming together, and I'm one of them. We are talking, we are writing. I hope people are reading, are listening, and they'll come up with programs that will help us to meet all our needs. Now, the problem, as I see it myself, is that in Africa, for example, we talked about food. Food security is becoming a problem. You know why? Because we are being told to grow high-value crops, to grow cut flowers, to grow fruits and vegetables, to grow lemon grass, so that we can mangoes and oranges, which we don't eat, so that we can export them and import food. But what is happening is that you grow oranges, you grow mangoes, you export them, and the revenue that we generate in foreign exchange, we use that to import arms and equipment, torture the people so that they don't fight for their rights. So the situation is not as simple as it seems. But change comes from the people. Once the people have set their minds on bringing about change, change will happen. And I think it is beginning to happen. I see in Africa, governments are some of them are stepping aside. Others are being forced to step down. I think we are reaching a stage where the people are going to demand change. And if change doesn't come by peaceful means, I guess in the last resort, something else will have to give. But the people have to have their human rights fulfilled. And in order to do that, everybody, governments, development partners, NGOs, community-based organizations, have to change their current mindset and develop a new mindset that can bring everybody to the table, discuss, agree on how to move forward. If this doesn't happen, we are going to continue talking and talking. I have been associated with UN since 1975. Every year there are conferences about poverty, about gender, about the environment. I would call upon our leaders and those they lead to now change the agenda, and when they come, they don't start debating what to do, but focus on what needs to be done, and they do it, and they monitor it, and make sure that what they have agreed upon is done. Otherwise, we are going to continue talking and talking and talking with very little done on the ground.
Thank you very much. Let me come to you immediately, Clarissa. Eric, talked about some very important things here. He talked about how, for example, in Latin America, there was a time when the rulers were basically military people. Mm. And, of course, for them, the priority was staying in power. And so their priority was what they characterized as national security, as reflected in how much they spent on their armies, which will protect them. He may need to know, and the audience should know, by the way, that even today, the largest country in Latin America, we're talking about Brazil, the president is Jair Bolsonaro. And guess what? Even though he was, in fact, democratically elected, he is, like me, a former soldier. He is a former soldier. Very interesting. Now, let me ask you this question. He also talked about the issue of changing mindsets, attitudes. How do you do it? Because you need, first of all, to mobilize people in order to demand their rights to be met. How do you do that? As a consultant on development.
That's a very interesting point you raised, actually. he talked about human rights as well, and I believe clean air and a healthy environment is everyone's right.
Yes.
So
it should be an inalienable right. In fact,
exactly,
a birthright.
Really. Exactly, it's a birthright. Mm. A lot of civic education needs to be done, and I'm glad a lot of people are talking about it in Africa, actually. In Zambia, we've had one of our satirical poets, he's a singer as well, Pilato, who has been talking a lot about it, and it's really, really interesting that he's taken it upon himself to make aware of what's going on in the environment. And I believe when people are campaigning, and we know that most campaign promises are never carried out, but I think climate, a safe climate or environment for the people should be one of the agenda items for anybody.
Mm.
So a lot of awareness is important. People need to know. It's not just at certain levels, right from the bottom.
Mm.
When you're in the U.S., you don't even have to think about it. You cannot throw a paper anyhow. That's keeping the environment clean.
If you do, you will be fined.
You'll be fined. And that's in the people. Everybody knows. You cannot just do it.
Singapore.
You cannot do it. When you go to other countries, say, for example, in Africa, someone is driving and they'll throw a bottle out or a plastic out of the car. And that's okay.
Is that what they do in Zambia?
Well, I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen.
Now, to the best of your knowledge, do Zambians have a right to own an opinion that may be different, for example, to the party in power?
Now, we know and we've seen and we've heard what has happened to anybody who has an opinion contrary to the ruling party or ruling government. You're held accountable for even the things that are right, things that you are entitled to.
So how do we bring about that sort of climate, that type of environment? Because it is very important, really, for bringing about social, economic, political justice for all.
I think education is very important. Educating even the leaders.
Education?
Yes. You need to get them to a point where you're seeing the problem at the same level.
I hope we are talking here about civic education, because I have seen, for example, in your neighboring country, Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe was led by President Robert Gabriel Mugabe for at least 32 years. He was arguably one of the most educated individuals anywhere.
Yes,
he had seven earned university degrees.
Yes, he was. Well,
so are we talking about that type of education, or are we talking about civic education?
We're talking about
where people, in fact, become socially and politically conscious, aware of their rights.
Yes, we're talking about civic education here, because someone can have all that education and not be educated in areas like that.
Yes.
So we're really talking about civic education. And I believe, say, for example, the Zambian government used to need to work with people like the people who are on the ground, who are taking this personally and going around talking about environmental change, environmental degradation and all of that, letting people know, whether it's in music or whatever area, they should see these as partners.
Sensitize.
Yes. They're sensitizing the people, but they should also see them as partners. They're working with them for a better Zambia or a better Africa, you know.
And for that to happen, you have to be able to mobilize.
Yes, you have to be able
and
to mobilize.
Organize, not agonize, as Ghana's founding president Kwame Nkrumah used to caution people not to agonize but to organize.
Yes.
Let me come to you, Ambassador Sani. Now, you have this most urgent problem of desertification in West Africa, particularly around the areas where you grew up and you came from. Any particular reason why, for example, governments have not attempted, at least I do not know of any initiative that has succeeded so far, in terms of recovering the desert? The technology is there. I was in Israel and I saw how, for example, the Israelis have, in fact, developed a technology that helps them grow some of the most, you know, healthiest foods, fruits, vegetables, you name it, right here in California. You go to San Joaquin Valley, a place that is reputed to be the bread basket of the world. When you see where they have grown rice and what have you and stuff like that, you see sand on the margins. I have seen reports suggesting that China, for example, has been able to recover large territory, made it into arable type of land that is fertile enough for, you know, for people living off the land. Why can't we do that?
Well, one cost, but before even we talk about the cost, let's look at the countries that are involved. China is one huge country, one government. When you talk about the Sahel, you're talking about almost about 13 or 14. It's almost about the whole ECOWAS region.
Right.
So you have that problem already.
Gaddafi had money. Did he try to do something?
Well, it's possible, but I'm just giving you some of the immediate constraints. I think the Sahel took some very important steps, recognizing the problem and forming the Sahel group, the SILS, back in the 70s. They were not talking about this desertification as such as what is going on in China, but at least they recognize the problem. So it's not going, they're not going to start. They've recognized the issue. Now we have to develop a strategy. I don't think they have one at this moment. And whether they're going to use the Israeli model or the Chinese model to be able to do that, I don't know. We have another immediate problem facing my own country, which is the Gambia. It is one of those countries that will be threatened by the rise in the sea level. It is low-lying. The capital itself is threatened. And we have to try to see how we can rebuild the coast, what we call beach nourishment, which was done back in the 2001, to be able to regain and reclaim some of the land that were already being taken over by the Atlantic Ocean. So we do have environmental issues, even within our own city, which we probably is amongst those cities that is going to go away in the year 2050 if nothing is done. So we do have that immediate problem, which is what we are trying to do right now as a country. But as a region, it is important that we, because the encroachment is already there, in northern Senegal, southern Mali, northern Mali rather, all of that area. So it is going to take some time to be able to do remedial or mitigative measures to be able to address those issues. This is where we are at the moment. And as I said earlier, is that we need to really try to educate the people, to link them, to link these issues with climate change so that they can appreciate the problem more. That some of it is really us, how we live, how we choose to live, to be able to at least modify the living standards so that we'll be able to impact the environment in a very positive way.
Educate, sensitize, and helping to change both attitudes and mindsets. Eric, how do we do that? And also, and also, is it possible for that to happen without a reasonable degree of good governance?
Well, let me first start with the issue of the mindset. In many parts of Africa that I'm aware of, we still believe in numbers, large numbers, many cows, many goats, many children. And experience has shown that when you have drought, those farmers that had many cows end up with a few saved than those who had few. Those who have many children, especially in areas where mortality rate is still high, they end up saving some children, whereas those with few end up with none. So we have to deal with this problem of numbers. How do we deal with it? How do we tell our farmers, our herders, you and I know where we come from, that our leaders have got the largest number of cows? So it becomes difficult for the president or the minister or my Gomorora chief who has 100 cows to tell me to have 20. So the issue of governance is important. The leaders have to set the example. If you have 30 cows, then you can tell others to have 20 or 10 or 5. But when you have got 1,000 in one area, 1,000 in another area, 3,000 in another area, then it becomes difficult to change the mind of other people to move from large to small numbers. That is one issue that we should address. The second one about the economic model. I'm a development economist. I don't believe in borrowing a model from another system. It does not work. What we need to do, as you are saying, Israel developed a farming system that suits Israeli conditions. China is developing a model that suits Chinese conditions. We should develop models that suit our conditions. I heard the guest from the Gambia talking about 13 governments and 13 countries and ECOWAS, and I covered ECOWAS from the UN. There's no way you are going to have one model, farming model, that fits everybody in West African region. Even if you take, say, Ghana, which I have studied very well, in the north, you have dry conditions. In the south, you have wet conditions. So you cannot have a farming model that can apply to the northern region of Ghana and the southern region of Ghana at the same time. It's not possible.
Unfortunately, Eric, time happened not to be our best ally. But the last question again, is that all possible without a reasonable degree of good governance?
Good governance is very important. And that's why I said the leaders should set the example themselves. Good governance means that the leaders must be transparent so that whatever they do, we can scrutinize and help them to do better. They must allow the people to participate in the process of formulating policies, strategies, implementing them, monitoring them, and evaluating them. And they must be held accountable for their omissions and commissions.
Unfortunately, once again, Eric, time is not our best ally. And on that note, our distinguished guests are Kralisa Kayosa Shegun, Sidi Sane, Eric Kashambuzi, and earlier in the show, we had Margaret Beshia. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa, and please remember to keep the African hopes alive.
welcome to learn.